Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the gas programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Jack Sharples, who's research fellow at the OIES, and we're here today to discuss the key messages from the recent chapter in the Gas Quarterly, Gazprom's Summer Sales Strategy and Capacity Bookings via Ukraine. Now, just to timestamp this podcast in an ever-changing world of the gas business, we are recording this podcast on the afternoon of Tuesday, the 27th of July. Welcome back, Jack. It's great to see you for the OIS podcast series.
Thank you. Great to be back.
Okay, now, Jack, before we start talking about gas flows into Europe from Russia, could you perhaps provide our audience with a kind of brief overview of the routes by which Gazprom delivers gas to Europe?
Yes, of course. So obviously the most famous route is the Nord Stream pipeline direct from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea. They also have the Yamal Europe pipeline that runs via Belarus and Poland to Germany. In the south, they have the Turkish Stream pipeline to Turkey. And from there, there are onward connections further into Southeast Europe, into Bulgaria, Serbia, North Macedonia and Greece. And finally, they have access to transit via Ukraine for deliveries to Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania.
Well, that's certainly quite a few routes they have into Europe. But to what extent are they being currently used relative to their capacity?
Well, the Nord Stream and the Yamal Europe routes are being used at full capacity. Both of those indeed have been at full capacity since August, so throughout the entirety of winter and through into this summer. In the Turkish Stream route, Gazprom is really limited by its counterparty nominations in southeastern Europe and the regional gas demand. Given that that region isn't really connected to central Europe, they can't funnel additional volumes that way. So the real swing is in transit via Ukraine, which is currently significantly lower than the system's physical capacity.
Okay, now you, of course, raise that route because much of the commentary is currently focusing on Gazprom's flows via Ukraine. So can you just remind us, you know, what is Gazprom's contractual arrangement for transit of gas on this route?
Yeah, well, there is a long-term contract in place that covers from January 2020 through to the 31st of December 2024. For the calendar year 2020, Gazprom had pre-booked and prepaid for 178 million cubic metres per day, which equates to around 65 BCM per year. From 2021 through to 24, they have pre-booked 110 million cubic metres per day, which equates to approximately 40 BCM per year. Then any additional capacity is offered at auctions by the Ukrainian TSO, GTSOU.
Okay, now, those auctions you just mentioned, you know, what products does the Ukrainian TSO, you quite rightly named GTSOU, offer, you know, and to what extent is Gazprom booking them?
Well, GTSOU offers a range of products. In recent months, they have been offering monthly firm capacity at around 15 million cubic metres per day and interruptible monthly capacity at around 64 million cubic metres per day. In addition to this, they've been offering quarterly firm capacity, again, around 15 million cubic metres per day, and annual firm capacity, again, around 15 million cubic metres per day. Now, up to this point, Gazprom has only booked monthly firm capacity, but it has booked everything that GTSOU has offered. It's the fact that they haven't been booking any of the other products that have been made available to them that has generated this chatter and controversy, let's say.
Okay, so I expect, therefore, now the key question is, if Gazprom is not booking all the available capacity via Ukraine, now, are they holding back volumes, you know, from the European gas market?
To answer that question, we really need to consider where the gas goes once it has been delivered via Ukraine. So those volumes are generally sold either to Poland in small volumes, given that most of the volumes going to Poland are delivered via Belarus, onto Slovakia for onward delivery to Austria and Italy, to Hungary and to Romania. So if Gazprom offered more via Ukraine, if it booked more capacity via Ukraine and offered more volumes via Ukraine, it's really a question of whether those markets in Central Europe would take up those volumes. Now, it seems likely that if Gazprom were to offer more to those markets, they probably wouldn't gain substantial extra sales by volume. but it could cause European hub prices to decline slightly by alleviating some of the nervousness around market tightness, especially with regard to volume sold to Austria, which is closely connected to the NetConnect market area in southern Germany, which in turn is obviously connected to the Gaspool market area in northern Germany and TTF in the Netherlands. So it's a bit of a question, really, of balancing out how much extra Gazprom thinks they could sell by volume and what impact they think this might have on the price of gas that they're selling.
Yeah, what's very clear, Jack, from what you're saying is, and what we all know, of course, Europe is so well interconnected with all these different routes. You know, there is ways and means of moving the gas around. So if Gazprom could theoretically sell more gas to Europe, even if it's only to Central Europe, you know, I just don't get it. Why is it not doing so?
Well, it seems to be a matter of portfolio optimization. And indeed, the general director of Gazprom Export, Yelena Burmistrova, made precisely this point at their most recent investor day back towards the beginning of the year. Gazprom has sold somewhere between 160 and 175 billion cubic meters of gas per year to the, let's say, the broad market that is the EU plus the UK in the past several years. And most of that has been on long-term contracts. Now, those long-term contracts, according to Gazprom Export, are mostly hub-indexed, this being a mixture of day-ahead, front-month, and forward prices. So any decline in European hub prices will mean almost immediately smaller sales revenues from Gazprom's long-term contract sales. So when Gazprom Export is deciding how much to offer the market, either via its electronic sales platform or directly on the European hubs via its trading subsidiaries, that is, over and above its long-term contract obligations, Gazprom Export needs to consider whether the revenues from those extra sales volumes would be enough to offset the loss of revenues from its long-term contract sales, where they're effectively potentially losing some revenues due to downward pressure on hub prices. Now, it seems to be the case that Gazprom Export has decided that the profits from those potential additional sales to Central Europe delivered via Ukraine would not be sufficient to offset any drop in revenues from long-term contract sales if, by offering more to the European market, they effectively caused hub prices to drop even slightly.
Right, but we're talking about a gas market with a fixed volume, or does Gazprom have any sales alternatives? Can it divert the gas to another market, or if it doesn't supply it into Europe or doesn't supply it onto the ESP, it just takes a complete lack of revenues? So will the gas ultimately be supplied to Europe or somewhere else? What do you think?
Well, I think if you look at the geography of Russian gas production, you can quite clearly see that everything that they are producing up and around northwest Siberia and more recently up on the Yamal Peninsula, all of that is either supplied to the domestic market or it is sold to Europe. The pipeline exports that Gazprom now has to China are delivered from completely separate gas production units in eastern Siberia. And in fact, there is no physical interconnection between western Siberia and eastern Siberia. So at present, it's simply not the case that Gazprom could divert those volumes elsewhere. Either they sell them to Europe or they don't sell them at all.
And of course, they can't send it into LNG in any way at all, can they?
No, Gazprom can't anyway. So, you know, Gazprom's only participation at present in LNG exports from Russia is at the Sakhalin 2 project in Russia's Far East. So again, that's, you know, a pretty much wraparound project with its own dedicated production. So Gazprom doesn't have the ability to liquefy its own gas and export it to other markets. It is planning to do so with its Baltic LNG project that they're sort of trying to develop in parallel, really, to Nord Stream 2, in the sense that they are they've actually just started construction on a gas processing plant just at the point where Nord Stream 2 sort of launches off the Russian coast into the Baltic Sea, with the plan being that they can process gas there, liquefy it, and then export it to markets that they currently can't reach via pipeline. Gazprom's most recent announcements on the subject seem to suggest that they're aiming for 2023 as a launch date, but I think that's likely to get pushed back potentially by a couple of years. So at present, they either sell the gas to Europe or they don't sell it at all. they're making plans to improve their access to market through LNG, but it's going to take several years.
Okay, well, Jack, getting back to the kind of main discussion point of this podcast, my question is, are the Europeans right to be concerned about what Gazprom is doing?
In fairness, probably not. We have to remember that Gazprom's European counterparties have pressured Gazprom for much of the past decade to increase the share of hub indexation in Gazprom's long-term contract pricing formula. This really stemmed from a situation, like I say, about 10 years ago, when Gazprom's oil-indexed contracts, the prices in those contracts diverged substantially from the predominant European hub prices at the time, thanks to the recovery in oil prices in 2010 and 11. And so Gazprom's European counterparties launched various arbitration cases. Gazprom adapted its contractual practices in sort of northwestern Europe and central Europe. And then in the settlement to the European Commission investigation into Gazprom, their anti-monopoly investigation, part of the settlement was not so much to discredit oil index pricing, but that Gazprom should take on commitments to offer regular pricing reviews in its its contracts with counterparties in the less competitive markets of Central and Southeastern Europe and the Baltic states. And that's really an implicit recognition that should those contractual prices diverge too far from hub prices, Gazprom has to offer these pricing reviews. And so it's a recognition that hub prices are really what should be aimed for in these long-term contracts. So Gazprom, followed this, and now its sales to Europe under long-term contracts are largely hub indexed. And last summer, when hub prices were very, very low, that was a painful period for Gazprom commercially. My colleague Vitaly Yermakov, in some of his work, has demonstrated that in the dog days of June and July and potentially August last summer, it's even possible that Gazprom was losing money on a cash basis for its long-term contract supplies via Ukraine to Central Europe, because when you take the sort of prevalent price in Central Europe at the time, the hub prices, and subtract the transportation costs, not only the transit via Ukraine, but the transportation costs in Russia, and the 30% export duty that Gazprom pays on its exports from Russia, and the cost of production naturally, and the mineral extraction tax that Gazprom pays on that, they could have been out of the money on a cash basis. So that was a painful period. Now, 12 months later, the boot is firmly on the other foot, and Gazprom is recouping some of its losses from last year. Now, there are those who are calling for Gazprom to add volumes to the market in order to bring the hub prices back down, potentially by either offering more volumes on its electronic sales platform or offering more volumes on European hubs, and then booking more transit capacity via Ukraine in order to deliver those volumes. But Gazprom has realized that given that most of its long-term contract sales are now mostly hub indexed, it's advantageous not to do anything that might rock the boat and actually bring the hub prices down. In other words, Gazprom has a commercial interest not to flood the market while prices are high, but instead to sort of benefit from these windfall revenues.
Yeah, and Jack, I remember many years ago sitting in gas conferences when certain people were asking for Gazprom to sell on hub prices. And at that point, other people were saying, yes, but if they do that, they actually control the hub price by supply. So it's very interesting. This was being talked about even when the pressure was being put on. But why don't we look forward a bit then, and ask, how does the current situation affect the outlook for the rest of summer 2021 and the upcoming winter 21-22? What do you think?
Well, the current high prices certainly reduce the likelihood of a wide seasonal spread, which reduces the current motivation to inject gas into storage. And that's part of the reason why we have seen such slow injections this summer. This is something, in fact, that we address in the quarterly. And it's why Europe is likely to begin the winter with anything up to 20 BCM, that is 20% less gas in storage than at the start of winter 2020-21. Now, that in turn is likely to reduce the room for manoeuvre if Europe experiences another cold winter, or even, we can look at factors outside of Europe. If another cold Asian winter pulls LNG cargoes away from Europe, or, you know, they say that lightning never strikes twice, but if there was another blockage in the Suez Canal, for example, that in some way interrupted Qatari LNG flows to Europe, or again, you know, unseasonably cold weather conditions in the US Gulf Coast that affect LNG loadings in America, that again potentially impact the flow of LNG to Europe. Anything that just triggers a shift in the supply-demand balance could lead to more substantial price spikes during the coldest part of the coming winter. Now, on the other hand, if the winter is mild and LNG cargoes remain freely available, then prices won't surge and the storage drawdown could be more moderate. So simply put, the current situation of these high prices today sort of demotivates some storage injections, and it increases the risk of pricing surges during the winter if the market tightens suddenly for any particular reason.
Yeah, and, you know, I just really reiterate to our listeners that, you know, in the past quarterlies, you know, it's been fascinating to me how the relationship between European gas storage and global gas prices and the flows of LNG, you know, is so interrelated. And, you know, therefore, you know, I urge you to keep an eye on our gas quarterlies, where we'll be keeping up to date on all these movements. But OK, Jack, you know, we've kind of coming to the end of our podcast, unfortunately. But, you know, we've also covered a lot of subjects in the past 20, 25 minutes. But as you know, I always like to end up by looking forward a little bit further and asking perhaps, you know, whether Gazprom's current activities tell us anything about the longer term expectations for its deliverability of gas into Europe and the roles of Ukraine capacity. Have you got any views on that?
Yes, I have. I think firstly, Gazprom knows that it has a window of negotiating opportunity, given that its current transit contract with Ukraine doesn't expire until December 2024. Now, by then, Gazprom is really rather hopeful that Nord Stream 2 will be up and running and operating at most of its capacity. And here we should remember that even though Nord Stream 2 makes landfall on Germany's Baltic coast, the aim of that project is largely to allow gas deliveries to Europe, to Central Europe and Italy, to circumvent Ukraine. This is due to the construction of the Ugal pipeline in eastern Germany down to the Czech border, the capacity expansion projects that have been undertaken in the Czech Republic and in Slovakia. So if all of this comes to pass, then Gazprom's need for transit via Ukraine post-2024 could be minimal, unless the European call on Russian gas increases substantially. So Gazprom is probably looking at Ukrainian transit post-2024 as something of a swing route, something that it would hope to book on more of an ad hoc basis as and when it needs it in response to European demand for Russian gas. Now, this is, to a certain extent, we've seen a foretaste of this with the capacity bookings, with the capacity auctions, rather, that GTSOU has been holding by offering this monthly, quarterly and annual capacity. And so I would just sort of draw the attention of our listeners to one interesting point, that on one of the most recent auctions on the 19th of July, GTSOU actually offered annual capacity for up to well over 100 million cubic meters per day. I think probably something closer to 120 million cubic meters per day for gas years starting from the 1st of October 2025 all the way to the gas year 2035-36. So effectively, what GTSOU offered Gazprom was to say, look, you can, you know, book this annual capacity out for another 10 years and effectively extend the current transit contract for another 10 years beyond its expiry. Now, Gazprom didn't book any of that capacity, and I think it has no reason to at present. Their negotiating sort of position will be much stronger, say, 2 years from now, when we know what the situation is with Nord Stream and we know what the situation is with European demand for Russian gas. So I think that's where we're at. I think GTSOU is trying to convince Gazprom to lock in some of this transit. There is political pressure from Germany and the United States to lock in some of this Ukrainian transit. But by contrast, Gazprom is very much looking at this now as saying, no, we want to get Nord Stream 2 finished and Ukraine will be a swing route. So I think that's our sort of longer term outlook. And it's going to be very interesting to follow this over the next several years as the end of that transit contract approaches to see how the situation plays out.
And of course, Jack, you know, we will be doing that at the OIS through your gas cordless, but of course through other papers which we publish. Well, look, you know, thank you so much, Jack. I always enjoy our discussions, you know, and a great chatter here today. You know, I really enjoyed the conversation, and I think our listeners will agree it summarizes very well the key messages from the recent gas quarterly. You know, I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.